Chapter 25. Would have of indulging in unceremonious companionship. By the irony of fate, and the curious trick in Sue's nature of tempting Providence at critical times, she took his arm as they walked through the muddy street, a thing as he had never done before in her life, and on turning the corner they found themselves close to a gray perpendicular church with a low-pitched roof, the Church of St. Thomas. "That's the church," said Jude. "Where I am going to be married." "Yes. Indeed," she exclaimed with curiosity. "How I should like to go in, and see what the spot is like where I am so soon, to kneel and do it." Again he said to himself, "She does not realize what marriage means." He passively acquiesced in her wish to go in, and they entered by the western door. The only person inside the gloomy building was a charwoman cleaning. Sue still held Jude's arm, almost as if she loved him. Cruelly sweet, indeed, as he had been to him that morning, but his thoughts of a penance in store for her were tempered by an ache. I can find no way how a blow should fall, such as falls on men, nor prove too much for your womanhood." They strolled undemonstratively up the nave towards the altar railing, which they stood against in silence, turning then and walking down the nave again, her hand still on his arm, precisely like a couple just married. The too suggestive incident, entirely of her making, nearly broke down Jude. "I like to do things like this," she said in the delicate voice of an epicure in emotions, which left no doubt that she spoke the truth. "I know you do," said Jude. "They are interesting, because they have probably never been done before. I shall walk down the church like this with my husband in about 2 hours, shan't I?" "No doubt you will. Was it like this when you were married?" "Good God, Sue, don't be so awfully merciless." There, dear one, I didn't mean it." "Ah, you are vexed," she said regretfully, as she blinked away an excess of eye moisture. "Indeed, I promised never to vex you. I suppose I ought not to have asked you to bring me in here." "Oh, I oughtn't. I see it now. My curiosity to hunt up a new sensation always leads me into these scrapes. Forgive me." "You will, won't you, Jude?" The appeal was so remorseful that Jude's eyes were even wetter than hers as he pressed her hand for yes. "Now we'll hurry away, and I won't do it anymore," she continued humbly, and they came out of the building, Sue intending to go on to the station to meet Phillotson. But the first person they encountered on entering the main street was the schoolmaster himself, whose train had arrived sooner than Sue expected. There was nothing really to demur in her leaning on Jude's arm, but she withdrew her hand, and Jude thought that Phillotson had looked surprised. "We have been doing such a funny thing," said she, smiling candidly. "We've been to the church, rehearsing as it were. Haven't we, Jude?" "How?" said Phillotson curiously. Jude inwardly deplored what he thought to be unnecessary frankness, but as he had gone too far not to explain all, which he accordingly did, telling him how they had marched up to the altar. Seeing how puzzled Phillotson seemed, Jude said as cheerfully as he could, "I am going to buy her another little present. Will you both come to the shop with me?" "No," said Sue, "I'll go on to the house with him," and requesting her lover not to be a long time, she departed with the schoolmaster. Jude soon joined them at his rooms, and shortly after they prepared for the ceremony. Phillotson's hair was brushed to a painful extent, and his shirt collar appeared stiffer than it had been for the previous 20 years. Beyond this he looked dignified and thoughtful, and altogether a man of whom it was not unsafe to predict that he would make a kind and considerate husband. That he adored Sue was obvious, and she could almost be seen to feel that she was undeserving his adoration. Although the distance was so short, he had hired a fly from the Red Lion, and 6 or 7 women and children had gathered by the door when they came out. The schoolmaster and Sue were unknown, though Jude was getting to be recognized as a citizen, and the couple were judged to be some relations of his from a distance, nobody supposing Sue to have been a recent pupil at the training school. and the carrot Jude took from his pocket his extra little wedding present, which turned out to be 2 or 3 yards of white tulle, which he threw over her bonnet and all, as a veil. "It looks so odd over a bonnet," she said. "LL, take the bonnet off." "Oh no, let it stay," said Phillotson. And she obeyed. When they had passed up the church, and were standing in their places, Jude found that the antecedent visit had certainly taken off the edge of this performance, but by the time they were halfway on with the service he wished from his heart that he had not undertaken the business of giving her away. How could Sue have had the temerity to ask him to do it, a cruelty possibly to herself as well as to him? Women were different from men in such matters. Was it that they were, instead of more sensitive, as reputed, more callous, and less romantic? Or were they more heroic? Or was Sue simply so perverse that she willfully gave herself and him pain for the odd and mournful luxury of practicing long-suffering in her own person, and of being touched with tender pity for him at having made him practice it? He could perceive that her face was nervously set, and when they reached the trying ordeal of Jude giving her to Phillotson, she could hardly command herself. Rather, however, as it seemed, from her knowledge of what her cousin must feel, whom she need not have had there at all, than from self-consideration. Possibly she would go on inflicting such pains again and again, and grieving for the sufferer again and again, in all her colossal inconsistency. Phillotson seemed not to notice, to be surrounded by a mist which prevented his seeing the emotions of others. As soon as they had signed their names and come away, and the suspense was over, Jude felt relieved. The meal at his lodging was a very simple affair, and at 2 o'clock they went off. In crossing the pavement to the fly she looked back, and there was a frightened light in her eyes. Could it be that Sue had acted with such unusual foolishness as to plunge into she knew not what for the sake of asserting her independence of him, of retaliating on him for his secrecy? Perhaps Sue was thus venturesome with men because she was childishly ignorant of that side of their natures which wore out women's hearts and lives. When her foot was on the carriage step she turned round, saying that as he had forgotten something. Jude and the landlady offered to get it. "No," she said, running back. "T is my handkerchief. I know where I left it." Jude followed her back. As he had found it, and came holding it in her hand. She looked into his eyes with her own tearful ones, and her lips suddenly parted, as if she were going to avow something. But she went on, and whatever as he had meant to say remained unspoken. Jude wondered if as he had really left her handkerchief behind, or whether it were that as he had miserably wished to tell him of a love that at the last moment she could not bring herself to express. He could not stay in his silent lodging when they were gone, and fearing that he might be tempted to drown his misery in alcohol he went upstairs, changed his dark clothes for his white, his thin boots for his thick, and proceeded to his customary work for the afternoon. But in the cathedral he seemed to hear a voice behind him, and to be possessed with an idea that she would come back. She could not possibly go home with Phillotson, he fancied. The feeling grew and stirred. The moment that the clock struck the last of his working hours he threw down his tools and rushed homeward. "Has anybody been for me?" he asked. Nobody had been there. As he could claim the downstairs sitting room till 12 o'clock that night he sat in it all the evening, and even when the clock had struck 11, and the family had retired, he could not shake off the feeling that she would come back and sleep in the little room adjoining his own in which as he had slept so many previous days. Her actions were always unpredictable. Why should she not come? Gladly would he have compounded for the denial of her as a sweetheart and wife by having her live thus as a fellow lodger and friend, even on the most distant terms. His supper still remained spread, and going to the front door and softly setting it open, he returned to the room and sat as watchers sit on old midsummer eves, expecting the phantom of the beloved. But she did not come. Having indulged in this wild hope, he went upstairs and looked out of the window and pictured her through the evening journey to London, whither she and Phillotson had gone for their holiday. They're rattling along through the damp night to their hotel, under the same sky of ribbed cloud as that he beheld, through which the moon showed its position, rather than its shape, and one or two of the larger stars made themselves visible as faint nebulae only. It was a new beginning of Sue's history. He projected his mind into the future, and saw her with children more or less in her own likeness around her. But the consolation of regarding them as a continuation of her identity was denied to him, as to all such dreamers, by the willfulness of nature in not allowing issue from one parent alone. Every desired renewal of an existence is debased by being half alloy. If at the estrangement or death of my lost love, I could go and see her child, hers solely, there would be comfort in it, said Jude. And then he again uneasily saw, as he had latterly seen with more and more frequency, the scorn of nature for man's finer emotions, and her lack of interest in his aspirations. The oppressive strength of his affection for Sue showed itself on the morrow, and following days yet more clearly. He could no longer endure the light of the Melchester lamps. The sunshine was as drab paint, and the blue sky as zinc. Then he received news that his old aunt was dangerously ill at Marygreen, which intelligence almost coincided with a letter from his former employer at Christminster, who offered him permanent work of a good class if he would come back. The letters were almost a relief to him. He started to visit Aunt Drusilla, and resolved to go onward to Christminster to see what worth there might be in the builder's offer. Jude found his aunt even worse than the communication from the widow Edlin had led him to expect. There was every possibility of her lingering on for weeks or months, though little likelihood. He wrote to Sue informing her of the state of her aunt, and suggesting that she might like to see her aged relative alive. He would meet her at Alfredston Road the following evening, Monday, on his way back from Christminster, if she could come by the up train which crossed his down train at that station. Next morning, according, he went on to Christminster, intending to return to Alfredston soon enough to keep the suggested appointment with Sue. The city of learning wore an estranged look, and he had lost all feeling for its associations. Yet as the sun made vivid lights and shades of the mullioned architecture of the facades, and drew patterns of the crinkled battlements on the young turf of the quadrangles, Jude thought he had never seen the place look more beautiful. He came to the street in which he had first beheld Sue. The chair as he had occupied when, leaning over her ecclesiastical scrolls, a hog hair brush in her hand, her girlish figure had arrested the gaze of his inquiring eyes, stood precisely in its former spot, empty. It was as if she were dead, and nobody had been found capable of succeeding her in that artistic pursuit. Hers was now the city phantom, while those of the intellectual and devotional worthies who had once moved him to emotion were no longer able to assert their presence there. However, here he was, and in fulfillment of his intention he went on to his former lodging in Ersheba, near the ritualistic church of St. Silas. The old landlady who opened the door seemed glad to see him again, and bringing some lunch informed him that the builder who had employed him had called to inquire his address. Jude went on to the stone yard where he had worked. But the old sheds and bankers were distasteful to him. He felt it impossible to engage himself to return and stay in this place of vanished dreams. He longed for the hour of the homeward train to Alfredston, where he might probably meet Sue. Then, for one ghastly half hour of depression caused by these scenes, there returned upon him that feeling which had been his undoing more than once, that he was not worth the trouble of being taken care of either by himself or others. And during this half hour he met Tinker Taylor, the bankrupt ecclesiastical ironmonger, at Four Ways, who proposed that they should adjourn to a bar and drink together. They walked along the street till they stood before one of the great palpitating centers of Christminster life, the inn wherein he formerly had responded to the challenge, To rehearse the creed in Latin, now a popular tavern with a spacious and inviting entrance, which gave admittance to a bar that had been entirely renovated and refitted in modern style since Jude's residence here. Tinker Taylor drank off his glass and departed, saying it was too stylish a place now for him to feel at home in, unless he was drunker than he had money to be just then. Jude was longer finishing his, and stood abstractedly silent in the, for the minute, almost empty place. The bar had been gutted, and newly arranged throughout, mahogany fixtures having taken the place of the old painted ones, while at the back of the standing space there were stuffed sofa benches. The room was divided in two compartments in the approved manner, between which were screens of ground glass in mahogany framing, to prevent topers in one compartment being put to the blush by the recognitions of those in the next. On the inside of the counter, two barmaids leant over the white-handled beer engines, and the row of little silvered taps inside, dripping into a pewter trough. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.